All right, welcome back to the deep dive. Today we're going way back to 1879. Buckle up.
Oh yeah, deep cut.
Yeah, for a deep dive into a legal case that might not be a household name like Brown v. Board or even Plessy v. Ferguson,
Right.
but it's called Green v. City of Bridgeton. And it gives us this really interesting glimpse into how courts were thinking about civil rights, particularly segregation, during the Reconstruction era.
Yeah, definitely. So after the Civil War, you have this really pivotal moment in American history. And this case, Green v. City of Bridgeton, even though it's not, a landmark case that everybody knows about, it is so important for understanding the legal landscape back then. What were the arguments? How did the courts reason through these issues? And, it's a precursor to the idea of separate but equal, which obviously becomes much more solidified later on.
Yeah, and it's fascinating to see how these early cases kind of laid the groundwork for what was to come, right?
Exactly. It's like the foundation.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's set the scene. It's 1879 in Georgia, and we have a black woman, and I'm going to quote here from the court records where she's referred to as a colored woman, which right off the bat kind of tells you something about the times.
Yes, it speaks volumes.
Right. She's trying to travel from Darien to Savannah on this steamboat called the City of Bridgeton.
Oh.
And so she goes to board the boat and she wants to sit on the upper deck.
Okay.
Now, this is where it gets really interesting because the case specifically states that the upper deck was the only area described as comfortable and convenient for passengers. And this area was, of course, reserved for white passengers.
Right. So we're already seeing this disparity. It's not just about separate spaces, but the quality of those spaces is immediately brought into question.
Exactly. And it's not just implied, it's right there in the case description.
Yeah.
So, of course, she's denied access to the upper deck. The purser won't take her fare and tells her to go to the lower deck, which was designated for colored passengers.
Right. And it's not a suggestion. They actually threaten to physically remove her if she doesn't comply.
Yeah, it wasn't a very welcoming environment.
Not at all.
So she tries to appeal this. She goes to the captain, hoping he might be, more reasonable or override the purser, but he doesn't. He backs up the purser's decision.
So she's stuck.
Yeah. She ends up being forced off the steamboat at Doughboy Wharf and having to wait for hours, like 6 hours, for another steamer.
Wow. So you can imagine the frustration and humiliation. This is a huge disruption to her travel plans, all because of her race.
And understandably, she feels that her rights have been violated. She feels humiliated. She sues for damages.
Makes sense. I mean, who wouldn't in that situation?
Yeah.
So what's the defense's argument here? How do they justify this blatant discrimination?
Well, their argument, it basically boils down to this idea that, racial segregation on the steamboat is just a reasonable regulation.
Reasonable. Okay, how do they define reasonable?
Right. They claimed that it's necessary for maintaining order and, effectively running their business. And then they go on to say that the accommodations provided for colored passengers on the lower deck are substantially equal to those provided for white passengers on the upper deck.
Ah, there it is. The separate but equal argument starts to take shape.
Exactly. And this phrase, substantially equal, this is going to become really key to understanding how the court eventually rules.
It's like the loophole.
Right. So let's shift gears a little bit and talk about the legal issue at the heart of this case. What was the big question the court had to grapple with?
Right. So basically, the court had to decide, could a common carrier, like a steamboat company in this case, legally segregate its passengers based on race as long as they provided substantially equal accommodations? It really boils down to the constitutionality of segregation.
It's a really pivotal question. And how did the plaintiff's side argue this? What was their basis for saying this was wrong?
Well, the plaintiff argued that she, as a paying passenger, had the right to the same level of comfort and convenience as any other passenger on that steamboat.
It's a pretty straightforward argument, equal access, regardless of race.
Exactly. It's about that fundamental principle of equality. And the defendant, what was their reasoning?
So the defendant's argument, it was based on two main points. One was that segregation, as we mentioned, was a reasonable way to maintain order and run their business smoothly.
Right, that reasonable regulation idea.
Exactly. And second, they kept hammering on this idea that the separate accommodations were substantially equal.
So their argument hinges on this idea that separate can still be equal.
Yeah, and it's interesting because they don't really address the inherent inequality that comes with separating people based solely on their race.
Right. It's like they're trying to sidestep the whole issue of discrimination by saying, hey, look, separate facilities, but they're equal, so no harm done.
Exactly. So those are the two sides. Now, the big question is, how did the court rule? What was the decision?
Well, the court ultimately sided with the steamboat company. They upheld the segregation policy, and it really came down to their interpretation of substantially equal.
So they bought the defendant's argument.
They did. They found that the cabin and the staterooms reserved for colored passengers were, in their opinion, basically the same as those provided for white passengers on the upper deck. And this is despite the plaintiff explicitly stating that the upper deck was the only comfortable and convenient area.
It seems like a pretty big oversight, like they completely ignored her actual experience.
It does, and it highlights how subjective this whole idea of substantial equality can be.
Yeah.
It allows for a really narrow interpretation of equality, one that ignores the social and emotional aspects of segregation.
Yeah, it reduces it to a checklist of physical features. So what other factors played into the court's decision?
Well, another key point was the court's emphasis on the lack of a specific federal law prohibiting segregation on steamboats.
So they're basically saying Congress hasn't explicitly said it's illegal, so it must be okay.
Right. And this speaks to a broader issue of how judicial interpretation, especially in the absence of clear legislation, can have a huge impact. The court's reasoning here essentially created a loophole that allowed segregation to continue.
Yeah. It seems like a pretty passive way to address such a fundamental issue of equality.
And to further bolster their decision, the court leaned on this concept of an implied contract. They argued that by boarding the steamboat, passengers agree to follow the company's rules, including their segregation policy.
It's like saying, you stepped on board, so you implicitly agreed to be discriminated against. It shifts the burden of responsibility onto the person being harmed.
Exactly. And perhaps most troubling, the court completely dismissed the plaintiff's claims of humiliation and mental suffering. They saw her being forced off the boat as a justifiable consequence of her refusing to comply with a policy they deemed lawful.
It's like they're saying her feelings don't matter. They're completely devaluing her experience.
It's a stark reminder of how the legal system can sometimes fail to protect the most vulnerable and uphold basic human dignity. So we've gone through the details of the case. But why does this matter today? Why should we care about this seemingly obscure case from 1879?
Great question. I think, first and foremost, this case shows us how the separate but equal doctrine wasn't just something that suddenly appeared with Plessy v. Ferguson.
Right.
It was already being developed and applied in lower courts.
Exactly. Green v. City of Bridgeton shows us the legal groundwork that was being laid for that more infamous decision.
Yeah, and it highlights the tension that existed between the ideals of equality, especially after the Civil War, and the passage of the 14th Amendment.
Yeah, 14th Amendment was huge in this context, especially the Equal Protection Clause, which was designed to ensure everyone had equal protection under the law.
Right, and yet you still have these prevailing social norms and legal interpretations that allowed for racial discrimination to continue.
It's a perfect example of how legal progress isn't always linear. There can be steps forward and then setbacks. And this case also shows how this idea of substantial equality could be used to justify segregation, even when it was clearly unequal in practice.
Right. And it reveals the limitations of those early legal victories, like the 14th Amendment and the Civil Rights Act of 1875.
Yeah, those were huge milestones. But this case shows they weren't a complete solution. They weren't enough to fully dismantle the systems of discrimination that were so deeply rooted in society. And it also raises some really critical questions for us to think about.
Yeah, like what are some of the things we can learn from this case? What should we be taking away from this deep dive?
Well, I think one of the biggest takeaways is the inherent inequality of segregation itself. No matter how you try to spin it, separating people based solely on their race sends a powerful message of inferiority.
Absolutely. It's about more than just physical spaces. It's about dignity and respect. And those are things that can't be easily measured or quantified.
Right. And the court, in this case, completely missed that. They focused solely on the physical aspects of substantial equality and completely ignored the subjective experience of the plaintiff.
They disregarded her humiliation, her sense of being treated as a second-class citizen.
Exactly. And this brings us to another important point. Legal formalism can be dangerous. When we focus too much on a narrow interpretation of the law, we risk overlooking the real human impact of those interpretations.
It's like checking off boxes on a list without truly understanding the consequences.
Precisely. And that can lead to outcomes that are unjust and perpetuate systems of oppression. So to bring it all back, what's the core takeaway from our exploration of Green v. City of Bridgeton?
Well, I think it's a stark reminder that seemingly neutral legal standards, like this idea of substantial equality, can be easily manipulated to maintain deeply ingrained inequalities.
Yeah, and it shows us the importance of always looking beyond the surface of legal doctrines and asking, who is this benefiting? Who is being harmed? And are we truly upholding the values of justice and equality for everyone?
It's a reminder that the fight for civil rights is an ongoing process. It's about constantly challenging those interpretations, pushing for a more expansive understanding of equality, and ensuring that the law truly serves all members of society.
Right. And Green v. City of Bridgerton, while not a household name, serves as a powerful lesson in that ongoing struggle. It's a reminder that legal progress isn't always straightforward, and it's up to each generation to continue pushing for a more just and equitable society.
Absolutely. And on that note, thanks for joining us for this deep dive into Green v. City of Bridgerton. We hope this has given you some food for thought.
Yeah, definitely lots to think about.
We'll see you next time.